I'm Jeannie Allen, and this is Reality Check.
Reality Check with Jeannie Allen is produced by National Review and is one of more than a dozen podcasts offered on the National Review online website. If you'd like a free subscription to the podcast so that you never miss a program, simply sign up at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. And now, here's Jeannie Allen.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. I'm Jeannie Allen. Our guest today is Mike McShane, a dear friend and the director of national research at EdChoice, an advocacy organization based in Indianapolis. Mike is also an author, editor, has 8 books on education policy under his belt, and he started his career as a 9th and 10th grade teacher in Montgomery, Alabama. There are so much I could say about his accomplishments, but what I want to do is get right down to a fascinating discussion with Mike McShane on Reality Check. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, Jeannie. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you. It is so great to have you with us. I really loved the article that you recently penned in Forbes, which was so timely, about the proposed new Supreme Court Justice, Brett Kavanaugh. And for our listeners who have not had a chance to read it, I urge you to go out now and pull it up as you're listening to this. Mike McShane of EdChoice's article is entitled, "Does a Justice Kavanaugh Mean That Blaine Amendments Are History?" And this is one of those fascinating subjects for me, Mike, that so many people don't really know about, and when they hear about it, no matter what their political viewpoints are and who they are, they just kind of go, what? What is that? So help us out. Let's just start really elementary. Can you tell our listeners, what are Blaine Amendments?
Sure. Blaine Amendments are anti-aid provisions that are included in, I think, 39 state constitutions that bar, quote-unquote, public dollars from going to religious organizations. Now, they get their name from a gentleman by the name of James G. Blaine, who was at one time the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. He was also a senator from the state of Maine and ran for president in 1884. But in the 1870s, he pushed for an amendment to the United States Constitution. He actually wanted to tack on some words to the end of the First Amendment, specifically barring aid to religious organizations. The reason for that was he was kind of riding a tidal wave that had started 20, 30 years before him of anti-Catholic bias that was really bubbling up in American politics. There have always been strains of anti-Catholicism since before even the American founding. But the Know-Nothing Party of the 1850s and the people that came after it really, really didn't like Catholics. And at this time, traditional public schools in America were really kind of Protestant organizations. Children read from the King James Bible, they sung hymns, and Catholics in various places were asking for equal treatment. In some cases, they said, hey, you know, during Bible reading time, can the Catholic kids read from the Catholic version of the Bible instead of the King James version? In others, they asked for schools, Catholic schools, to be set on equal footing when it came to public funding, as the sort of Protestant public schools were. And a whole lot of people did not like that. There are these, you know, very crazy stories. The Philadelphia nativist riots, which took place when Catholics and Protestants were arguing about what Bible should be read in school. So it was really a kind of powder keg of things. And there are historical debates as to whether Blaine himself was an anti-Catholic or whether he was just trying to kind of ride this wave of anti-Catholic sentiment.
Because he wanted to be president? Is that presumably why we think that even back in 1870s they were thinking that way?
Yep. Wanted to be president or wanted... there were some other... I think what Ulysses S. Grant was another person who was kind of popularizing these views, so maybe trying to curry favor with him. But the functional result was that this language started to pop up in more and more state constitutions all across the country.
And so first I want to back up before you even get to the language, because I find it really interesting that, you know, you're back in the 1800s, there are these arguments like, oh my gosh, that Bible's not the right Bible. How about our Bible? And there's actually talking about Bibles, period, in schools, because a lot of people don't realize that actually most of our institutions, even when we created public schools, were actually going on education was going on in these one-room schoolhouses, sometimes churches, sometimes homes. Talk a little bit. Let's just reset the table again, because if we are girding our loins, so to speak, to use a religious analogy, for a potential Justice Brett Kavanaugh that might help us relook at what schooling is and is not permitted to do at a public level. Let's remind everybody, what was schooling? What was happening in these days?
Yeah, I mean, if we go all the way back to before the American founding, I mean, the very first law written about education in America was in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and I want to get my dates right. I think it was like 1647, 1649, I think somewhere in that time period. Okay. It's affectionately known as the Old Deluder Satan Law, because it was a law in the Massachusetts Bay Colony that said any community of a particular size had to tax itself to pay for a teacher for the children of that community, because that old deluder Satan wants to keep our children illiterate so they can't read the Bible and reach their salvation. So in many ways, you know, from the dawning of the American experiment, there was a religious element in our schooling system. It wasn't until much later. In fact, what was it? Prayer wasn't, you know, decisions about whether prayer could be done in public schools are, you know, of a much more recent vintage than even those questions. But when we think about, yeah, this very decentralized education system intertwined with local religious organizations was the dominant form of education. We see some standardization start to take place with folks like Horace Mann and the Common Schools Movement in the 1840s, but that was by no means a widespread American trend. Mm-hmm. You know, the real sort of centralization and standardization really picks up in kind of the progressive era, the teens, the 20s, leading up into World War II, when it really sort of all comes together. But yeah, our education system was this vast, decentralized mix of religious and non-religious and urban and rural and classrooms and schoolhouses that had, you know, kids in grades K through 12 all learning together, and in some places, you know, teaching Latin and right. Some places teaching others. So it's a very, very diverse, decentralized system.
Diversity, lots of options, a lot of the stuff that we are trying to get back to today because we went to that cookie cutter system. I mean, when you start talking about the teens and 20s, the increased numbers of immigrants, looked down upon once upon a time by elite society, people like my relatives, I don't know about yours, but the Irish and Italians.
Mine too. Yep.
Right? We were just kind of, you know, dirty people who, you know, God forbid that our religion even play a role in society. There was this amazing amount of bigotry and discrimination going on that was trying to prevent anyone from even being near what they were, their culture and their own religion in schools. So flash forward 2018, Justice Kennedy announces his retirement. We got Brett Kavanaugh standing by, and you go last night, and this is on your July 10th, Mike McShane, Forbes article. Last night, President Trump nominated Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. I will leave it to the legal scholars to assess the broad implications of a potential Justice Kavanaugh, you say, but I do want to look at this narrow issue that might come before him. Why would the Blaine Amendment potentially come before him over his tenure? Tell us about what's in the wings.
Sure. So last year, a court case from the great state of Missouri, where I am speaking to you from today. I'm a resident of Kansas City, Missouri. It's a beautiful day. Everything is up to date in Kansas City.
So think,
in case you were worried. but a case came out of our backyard in Columbia, Missouri, called the Trinity Lutheran, which challenged Missouri's Blaine Amendment. So it was a case of a Christian preschool in Columbia, where the University of Missouri is located, for those of you trying to orient yourselves. And that school wanted to participate in the state's scrap tire recycling program. So it had this program that if you wanted to redo your playgrounds with recycled tires, the state would reimburse you for that. And so Trinity Lutheran applied. Its application was one of the highest rated of all of them. It should have, but the state denied them and said, we can't actually give this money to you because you are a religious organization. That was challenged all the way to the Supreme Court. And in fact, in a 7-2 ruling, the Supreme Court ruled that excluding Trinity Lutheran and the people, the children who would benefit from this program and the school from that program, violated their free exercise rights granted to them or protected for them in the First Amendment to the Constitution, saying that religious organizations should be able to participate in government programs that are neutrally administered. That is to say, that religious organizations shouldn't get bonus points for being religious. So in the application, they shouldn't have gotten extra points because they were religious. They shouldn't have lost points because they were religious, but they should just be treated on equal footing as all of the other organizations that participated in those. And where this gets interesting is that the case was very specific. There is a footnote 3, in fact, that says this case just is dealing with the sort of question at hand about redoing the pea gravel playground. We don't want to make broader arguments about what this could mean. And in many ways, it's sort of a sop to this idea around school choice programs. So as more and more school voucher programs, education savings account programs proliferate around the country, in some cases, they are challenged under Blaine Amendment grounds. It said that public dollars cannot go to religious schools, and children taking a voucher to a religious school under this particular line of argument would violate those. I think it is very likely that under the same grounds of the Trinity case, someone is going to say, wait a second, my free exercise rights are being violated by not allowing a religious organization or for me to send my child to a religious school on equal footing as non-religious options.
There's also, right, a lot of different legislatures across the country that use Blaine as a smokescreen to prevent them from even debating the argument. So could that also potentially enable them or empower them as they go? How informed do you think they are, or do they need to be, to even take that plunge?
Well, I think they are becoming increasingly known about this. I think as, for good or for ill, our Supreme Court justice nominations are becoming national news stories, and lots of analysis is coming out of that. And I think more and more people are learning about this and are figuring this out. So I think states will know this, but I think you're exactly right. We don't know how many bills were sort of killed before they even, you know, got out of the drafting stage because some lawyer for the state or an enterprising staffer said, oh, wait a second, we've got this Blaine Amendment, so we shouldn't even try doing this. So I think it definitely has an incredible opportunity to kind of open the floodgates and to have lots more states who otherwise would not want to have these programs actually try and implement them.
Mike, you're absolutely right. The other interesting thing about, I think, the Blaine Amendment in the U.S. Supreme Court is it just seemed like for years, whenever there was a discussion, let's say there was a state, they were going to try to do something, some opponent, because, you know, if it wasn't some ridiculously uninformed and falsehood like, oh, you know, educational freedom and options don't help people, and it really doesn't matter if you're going to the traditional public school because they're better than everything else or whatever they opponents come up with, they'd say it's unconstitutional. And then you'd say, well, maybe we should take the Blaine Amendment to the Supreme Court. And some people would say, no, because it's not a federal issue. But your argument is actually it is a federal issue.
Well, it is in the sense that if state constitutions sort of circumscribe your federally protected rights, then you take them to the Supreme Court to challenge them. So I think our First Amendment rights supersede what the sort of individual states are able to do. So it's just like a state couldn't draft a law banning a particular religion, or they couldn't pass a law, even if their constitution said that it was okay, the federal constitution says, no, you're not allowed to do that. So I think in this case, people have a very reasonable claim to say, look, all we're asking for is these programs or these religious institutions to be treated just like everybody else, not to be given special treatment and not to be discriminated against, but just to say, if we're going to have these programs that allow children choices between their schooling options, that they should be able to have choices for religious options. And if you think about it, I mean, this logic shows up in so many other social programs, and I don't hear the same kind of bellyaching about it that you hear about with respect to education, right?
No.
People in the great state of Missouri take their Medicaid dollars to Cardinal Glennon Hospital, or I was born in St. Luke's Hospital, and I imagine people are using Medicaid dollars to have their children taken care of there. So there's all sorts of these programs, social programs, where we don't really have any problem with that. And in fact, if you go back to some of the oral arguments of Trinity Lutheran, a lot of the justices sort of ask all these hypothetical questions and sort of say, okay, wait a second. So you folks are saying that, you know, the government can't aid religious organizations. Well, what if a church catches on fire? I mean, the government aids them because the fire department comes and puts it out. God forbid there's a shooter at a church. The SWAT team is going to show up and do something about that. That's technically government aid for those.
Right.
And they ask all sorts of other ones. It's like, well, what if they want to get rid of asbestos? Because asbestos is, you know, harming people's health. Would we not let them participate in those programs? So it's sort of both. There's an inconsistency within other social programs.
Energy saving tax credit windows,
yeah,
or solar panels. If a church or a Catholic or a Lutheran school wanted to do solar panels, would we not give them the same tax credit that my friend just got for doing that at his home on the beach?
Yeah, so having all of these things just administered neutral. So yeah, there's this contradiction across other programs, and there's this sort of never able to draw an actual bright line in reality to these, where a lot of these arguments fall apart.
Well, and so you also point out in your Forbes article the Zelman versus Simmons-Harris case, the 2002, I believe, was it, school choice case made it to the Supreme Court from Ohio. And as you point out, Justice Kennedy was part of the majority. But the other wonderful result of that case, besides sanctioning the ability of students within Cleveland and Ohio to have the option to use a scholarship to go to a private school, is that remarkable line, I can't remember it specifically, Mike, maybe you can, from Justice Sandra Day O'Connor about the parent is the conduit. Right. In other words, it's not going directly to the church, it's not subsidizing religion. This is the other thing we talk about. You just mentioned hospitals. People take their Medicare. There are people right now having a child, God bless them, in a hospital someplace with a crucifix in the hallway, and maybe they have nothing to do with the crucifix in their life, right? But it's being publicly subsidized, and thank God they're in the hospital able to have a baby in this day and age. The parent, though, is the person who makes the decision where they would like the money that's allocated for their kids to go. Is that how that kind of came down?
No, that's exactly right. And it's the same thing that we think of, you can take a Pell Grant to a religious college. You can take the GI Bill to a religious college. In many of these cases, the idea is that money isn't a check that is cut directly to, you know, St. Stanislaus Catholic School. I think we would generally say that is goes too far on the side of the establishment of religion. But if it is through the free choice of individuals, that is to say, I get a voucher and I can choose from a variety of different organizations. I could choose a secular one, I could choose a Catholic one, I could choose a Jewish one, I could choose a Muslim school, I could choose any of these different types of schools, and they're competing on equal footing to one another, the government is not establishing a religion. I mean, the way I think about it, and I should say, I'm not a lawyer, so I, you know, never really encountered these things in law school or in any other formal training. But the way I think about this issue is the First Amendment provides a kind of set of guardrails. So on one side, it says that the government cannot establish religion. That's why we don't cut checks directly to St. Stanislaus Catholic Church. But on the other side, it cannot prevent the free exercise of religion. That is to say that these religious people and religious organizations have a place in society. They can't be discriminated against solely because of their religious affiliations. And so the question is, how do programs fit within those two guardrails? And so, just the examples that we've given of school vouchers, of Pell Grants, the GI Bill, Medicaid, of all of those examples seem to me to say, okay, wait a second, we're not establishing a religion, because it's not only Catholic hospitals that can participate. There's secular hospitals. There's all sorts of these people that can do it. And the only reason they're choosing one of these is the religion is sort of incidental to the process.
Right.
They're going in the example you get. They're showing up because they want to have a baby.
They want to have a baby, and they've chosen that place to have a baby. Yeah,
for sure.
Well, and so let's also switch, just because it's related too. Let's say it wasn't even an issue. We didn't have to worry about a Blaine Amendment, though there are, 38 states that have these pernicious, is that right, 38?
Yeah, 38, 39, something.
Okay.
I can never forget, and there's sort of ranges of them. So some say very strong Blaine Amendments and weaker Blaine Amendments.
Right.
So depending on what state you have, the language is a bit different. But yeah, I think 39 fall under that identification.
This is one of the major reasons that you may not have educational options, freedom among a wide variety, including private schools in your state. So, number one, that's something that, don't you think, Mike, we should be telling people that they should ask their legislators if they're willing to help with, and as well as understand about a Supreme Court nominee. But let's say this was not even an issue. You've done a lot of research and analysis yourself on the value to students, particularly low-income and at-risk students, of having a religious education. Isn't there some superiority in terms of results, both in terms of college, retention, and productivity, that we should also make sure people understand?
Yeah, there's a long research history, particularly of Catholic schools. And Catholic schools, going back to James Coleman in the 60s, and earlier work in the early 1980s and others, that there really is... Yeah, there's a strong tradition of that, particularly for lower income students and minority students. Catholic schools have a really proud tradition of those. And actually, you know, fundamentally, I mean, some of the research that I did way back, you know, was talking about how there's a broad literature in political science that talks about how organizations that are united by a common mission tend to be more effective than organizations that aren't. And so religiosity or religious ethos or a religious sort of philosophy or underpinning, I think functionally serves to help schools and other organizations, but particularly schools, recruit a staff that shares the same mission, mm-hmm. work with parents and students that share the same mission, and really inculcate in the whole organization this idea that kind of we're all rowing the boat in the same direction. Unfortunately, you know, in lots of traditional public school systems, if you were to survey the teachers or you were to survey the principals or you were to survey the parents and you were to ask them, like, what is the purpose of this school? Like, why are you here? What are you trying to do? You would get dozens and dozens of different answers mm-hmm. because lots of people read their own kind of stuff into public schools and what they're supposed to do.
Right.
Whereas in lots of religious schools, you would see much more unity around what we're doing every day and why we're doing it. And I think that ultimately that will lead to more effective institutions.
Such a great point. And as we've seen, whether it's here in D.C., even though a comparably small scholarship program, to Cleveland, to Florida, when there is that tight-knit community, if you will, students who particularly aren't in the safest or the most tight-knit communities are able to get that, right? And so those values, those very values that frankly produced our country, are present and very obvious in the educational process.
Yeah, one of the things we have to think about is how schools are more than just factories that churn out kids that can read and do math. Now, it's, again, totally important that kids can read and do math, but there are also deep wells of social capital. There's a fascinating book that was written by two scholars at the University of Notre Dame called Lost Classrooms. I think it's called Lost Classroom, Lost Community. It came mm-hmm. out a couple years ago. Peg Brinig and Nicole Steele Garnett wrote it, where they studied the effect of Catholic schools closing in Chicago. And what they found was when Catholic schools closed, a whole bunch of bad stuff happened, right?
Wow.
Crime goes up, measures of social cohesion go down, because these schools were anchors of their community, and they were deeply interwoven into the fabric of their community and provided students a way to tap in to that social capital that existed in that community. And when those schools close, you know, nothing good comes in to replace that. So thinking about schools as these social organizations, as organizations that can help connect students to each other and to their community. I mean, I think if we look across the country, we have a serious problem of disconnected people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people who aren't connected to each other, they aren't connected to their community. And that isolation breeds all sorts of bad stuff. So how can we think of schools connecting people? And one of the things that religious schools have, private schools have, or really any school that tries to have a specified ethos and philosophy that undergirds it, is connecting people to one another around common ideas. We all think Maria Montessori is great, and the way that she views child development mm-hmm. is awesome. That's great. Let's all get in this building together and try and make it happen.
Right.
That's a way to unite people around a common thing. But it's not just, well, we think education is good, and kids need to be here, so let's ring the bell and get them all inside.
And
so how can we have that kind of unified focus?
And how can we make sure that even in a traditional public school environment, who now basically are so afraid to even say something like the golden rule or that came from religion, right? I mean, what Blaine not only did, what he did was not only prevent us from having access and having more people have access to these community building institutions that really do become part of the fabric of your society and sustain that fabric, but it made everyone scared to say and do anything. I mean, there obviously are lots and lots of other issues outside of schooling. But so
totally.
Right? So help me help me wrap this up then. Then so if the court found these amendments unconstitutional, right? If Brett Kavanaugh gets in, Rand Paul makes up his mind, everybody's really happy, does then that allow us to start chipping away at these roadblocks to vouchers and similar programs? So, you know, in other words, what extent would Kavanaugh's appointment speed up progress so we can get back on the road to a better society?
Yeah, so I think a couple of steps. I mean, I think so. First step is that I think states across the country, I mean, Missouri could be one of them and others, should be comfortable in saying, based on the Trinity Lutheran ruling, vouchers should be permissible, right? And that Blaine amendments shouldn't stand in the way. And perhaps that inevitably that will be challenged. But it's quite possible that a state Supreme Court would say, look, according to Trinity's logic, this is okay. And, mm-hmm. and so the program, it could actually be moot without ever reaching the U.S. Supreme Court, right? Like a state could just say, based on Trinity Lutheran, and I think they would be on firm footing to say, hey, look, there was this other program in Missouri that basically did the same thing, and the U.S. Supreme Court said that it was okay. This is probably okay, too. So just on those grounds. Now, that's maybe some wishful thinking. Most likely, state courts will still say, look, because it wasn't specifically ruling on this type of issue, it's going to need to make it all the way up to the Supreme Court.
That's right.
And then, yeah.
Right. That's
you know.
Right. We'll just get your engines running. Let's move them up. Let's move them up the ladder, up the rung, so we can get that case in Washington, right? That's what we should be saying
yeah.
to people.
Yeah. And it looks like there's a case that the Montana Supreme Court is seeing, I think, a Blaine Amendment challenge case on their school voucher program right now. I think there are lots of other programs. And in some ways, they're non-education-based programs, but there are others that could be challenged. But no, I would like to see, you know, lots of states should be testing this because, like I said, I think the logic of Trinity Lutheran should apply here. And I think that if that makes it to the Supreme Court, it will be vindicated.
Well, you've heard it here, folks. Assuming that we get a Justice Kavanaugh, you all should start by reaching out, pushing your lawmakers. First of all, electing great lawmakers that actually believe that educational diversity and freedom is important. And secondly, pushing them to get a program passed that maybe everything will converge at the court and we can get rid of this silliness and get on with educating people because gosh knows we need it. Right, Mike?
Absolutely.
Mike, it's such a pleasure to have you on this edition of Reality Check. Thank you so much.
A joy as always, Jeannie.
I have been speaking to Mike McShane. He is the head of national research at EdChoice. Thanks so much for joining me. I hope you will join us, Mike, as well as all of our listeners in Miami on October 25th and 26th for CER's Silver Anniversary Summit and Gala, where this and many other issues for learners at all levels will be discussed. Reality Check is a weekly podcast produced by National Review and posted on Monday at nationalreview.com. If you like what you heard in this podcast, and I hope you did, you might want to subscribe for free and make sure you don't miss any future programs. You can subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. And you can also find much more about education reform, opportunity, and innovation at the Center for Education Reform's website, edreform.com. Don't forget, tune in to Reality Check every week.